This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It's the first week of April, and April is Poetry Month. So we are so pleased to feature two conversations with poets who use their genre to talk about some big issues. First, we talk with poet, geologist, and translator Forrest Gander about his novel in poetry, Mojave Ghost. It's a lyrical journey through the arid landscapes of the Mojave Desert that interweaves ecological awareness with personal loss. Then we revisit my 2019 conversation with poet Damaris Hill about her book of poems, A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing. It's a searing, poetic exploration of Black women's incarceration and resistance throughout American history. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Pulitzer Prize winner Forrest Gander trained as a geologist, but became a poet, translator, and novelist. Over a period of time, he walked along much of the 800-mile San Andreas Fault toward the desolate town of his birth in the Mojave Desert. He traversed a topography that was both physical and spiritual. Gander's book-length poem, Mojave Desert, illuminates the interconnection between self and landscape and between loss and renewal. He tells us, we're losing landscapes at an alarming rate, and poetry can help us listen more closely to what's at stake. Let's listen now. Forrest Gander, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks, Francesca. I'm really glad to be here with you.
So this is just a beautiful volume of poetry, but you describe it as a novel poem. What do you mean by that?
Well, in sort of both senses, I felt like I had to write this book in a different way than any of my other books. It seemed to call for a less acrobatic syntax and line break. So it's almost sentence-based. And it also has a trajectory that a geographical and time trajectory that moves from the Ozarks of Arkansas to California, and then follows the journey from Northern California along the San Andreas Fault to the Salton Sea, where the San Andreas Fault ends, about 650 miles. So it's a book of poems, but it has narrative elements, and it's new in the sense of novel for me also.
How so?
In those ways I just mentioned, that I haven't used a line like this before. There's no titles for the poems. It's sort of a book-length sequence or story that involves walking the line between grief and the hope for happiness, and then physically walking the line that marks the split in California. So the geology and topography and my inner spirit, my inner life, become almost metaphors of each other.
Yeah, so poems express a deep connection between your personal, intimate history and the long history of the land. Now, you were born in the Mojave Desert, so this is a kind of coming home to you. And you also began your professional journey in life as a geologist. So first, just talk a little bit about what you love about that landscape and how it spurred you to study it first and then to write poetry about it.
Well, my mother fell in love with the desert first. She had grown up in Kansas and then lived in around Virginia for a little bit, but she had me while she lived in Barstow in the Mojave Desert. And she was a young mother and excited about everything. She was an amateur naturalist. And though she later felt horrible about doing this, she was just figuring out how to raise her first child. So she would actually leave me in the crib or in my playpen for hours at a time while she took breaks because I was exhausting her, and she would walk, walk in the desert. And she got to know the desert really well, the incredible geology around Barstow, which includes Rainbow Basin, this huge geosyncline, and a place that geologists love to go and study. Multicolored rocks, multicolored formations, and full of fossils. So her talking about the desert and her love for the desert in my childhood and then all through my life invested me with a sense that it was something I wanted to explore also. And I went on to explore lots of deserts in China and Northern Africa and across the United States and in Latin America. And I found that, well, I found that the same things that people have found for eons, that humans have gone into the desert seeking visions from multiple cultures across multiple continents, because the desert opens you up, because it changes your sense of time and you feel your vulnerability, and it changes your perspective so that you become vulnerable, opened up, you see differently, you think differently, your sense of time is altered, and you can come to feel insights that you wouldn't otherwise have had, partly because of that intense silence that you're inside of also, which is hard to find in our normal culture among so many others.
Yes, it's remarkable. I remember, many years ago, I went to Chaco Canyon and stayed overnight there. That was before the visitor center. You could do things like that. And it was so silent that I heard the beatings of the wings of a bird that I had never heard on the East Coast here, where everything is covered in forest. Really remarkable. So what you say about that new vision, the landscape appears barren at first, but it's anything but. Is that right?
That's right. So the experience you had is the one that others have too, who stay long enough. I mean, it's like a lot of people go to the desert, they go to Barstow, they go to the lowest point in the United States in Death Valley, and they get out of their car and they walk for 10 minutes and then they come back. And they, of course, don't experience the desert, even though they might have taken a photograph of it. But to actually be in the desert for a while is to realize that it's not an empty place, and that it's full of subtle sounds and full of life. And it's not just a dead, vacuumed out landscape. But you have to have intensified sensory engagement with it to feel that.
And I wonder if you could read, there's a poem on page 39 that is very much about the desert. It starts out with, "So what if worlds are boundless?"
Sure. So as we said, there are no titles for the poems. They're just sequential, and there's just an asterisk, like a little star that hovers above each of the poems. So what if worlds are boundless? I caught myself filling with the non-returnable particularity of this one afternoon, squatting and listening to a desert marigold bloom, when the hum of an invisible plane made me suddenly aware of the sprawling underflow of stillness around me. It was not loneliness I felt, but some nevertheless of enchantment. Those constant bearers of meaning bore me. I want to open wide now to the absence of concept, understanding, representation, to the inward flare of exhilaration, to the gratuitous revelation of mineral forces? Isn't the materiality of this Joshua tree, its living presence, more than what it means?
Say a little bit more about that, because I think this is very much about, I read something that you said about this book in which you said it's an exigent attempt at deep listening. And I think this poem is really an exemplar of that.
Yeah. And that sense at the end of the Joshua tree, its living presence more than what it means. Sometimes I think there's a beautiful thing that Wittgenstein says. He says, don't think, look. And I think that often we conceptualize things. We see the Joshua trees, which are dying and which we're told will probably not come back in our lifetimes because of the way we've changed the desert with global warming. And so we see something and we have these ideas about it before we actually make contact sensorily with it. But coming close to the Joshua tree, not looking at a distance and seeing it up close and feeling it and smelling it and seeing how the sun reflects on it and the lizard that's climbing up around the bottom of the base of the tree, that our sensual engagement gives us an intelligence and a contact with the world that we don't get through our ideas. The notion of ideas leading to thing is kind of reversed from perhaps the way it has been with other cultures that that believe that our ideas come from the contact with the world. That whole thing about Descartes, who says, I think, therefore I am, as if your thinking could take place in some nowhere that wasn't already engaged with the world, because our thinking comes out of our engagement with the world. So part of what the desert does, I think, is it strips down our conceptual life, and we're blasted with engagement, with heat, with a merciless sun, with a desert that seems barren at first and then begins to open up for us. And really, that's the kind of experience that sharpens our senses and that we want to live every day, but it's hard to get out of the familiar ruts of behavior and engagement with what's outside of us, because it becomes our ordinary.
Yes, and this goes even deeper than what you just said, because the connection between landscape and the history of the landscape with one's own intimate life and intimate history is very real in this book, and it's actually part of your philosophy. I mean, you've mentioned being influenced by Sangam literature from South India. Tell us about that and how this connection between your personal, your intimate life and the external life, the environment, works in this book and in your life.
Well, I think it works the same way that it works in your life too, Francesca, and in all our lives, though we aren't always very aware of it. But I think that the reason that we have this environmental disaster that we're living in, this massive extinction rate, the global warming, the changes that are taking place on the planet, because of the way we live on the planet, because we take the earth for what as something that we can extract materials from, that our relationship is completely transactional. whereas we are part of the earth, that we're connected to it, and that like the gut system inside of us is filled with bacteria that we are made of, other creatures that connect us to the outside of ourselves, that our self isn't a single self, that it's a multiplicity, and that other cultures have long before us, like the Sangam literature, which comes from southern India from about 2,000 years ago. For 300 years, people were writing in a tradition called Akam in southern India, where it was considered not only unethical, but impossible to write about the self without writing about the landscape around the self, the habitat, which influences the self and is part of any of our feeling and conception. And I think we can re-educate ourselves to mend our sense of our relationship with the world by considering the ways that other cultures have done that more healthily. In Bolivia right now, for instance, where I've spent time because I translate Bolivian writers, Bolivia has acknowledged that the non-human, including processes like rivers, have rights. And I think that unless we come around to thinking the same thing, that our lives and the lives of many other species here are really going to be doomed. What we call life on Earth will radically, radically change.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with poet, geologist, and translator Forrest Gander about Mojave Ghost, his book-length poem that merges the exterior landscape of the Mojave Desert with the interior landscape of the poet's own emotional and spiritual topography. I was very hopeful a couple of weeks ago when I saw that there was a dam that was taken down. I'm not sure whether this was the story about the dam or just a story of positive stories about the environment, but that idea of rivers having legal status, even because, of course, in our modern culture, we have to put things into frames like legal status where there can be, you know, some quantitative quality applied to them. But they attained legal status. And I think that, you know, may force our culture to slowly begin to turn around those kinds of concepts. But you also, you know, I was thinking when I was reading this wonderful poetry volume, Mojave Ghosts, of the noetic idea as above, so is below, so as external, so is internal. It's very much an elegy for relationships in your life, that of people who have passed on, as well as current ones, your current wife. So talk about the connection, this kind of, you speak of yourself as a combinant person and a kaleidoscopic self, in which these relationships, it is relationships that are really key here, not separateness, but relation.
That's a good question to ask, and it really follows from what we were just talking about, the way that the self is composed of so many other creatures, and even our DNA contains DNA from creatures that long ago became part of our system. But one of the things I became, I sort of had, like I think a lot of us do, a sense of myself as singular. I wake up, I recognize my mind and my body, and I have a kind of singularity. But after losing in very quick succession my wife of 35 years and my mother, and then also my sister, my younger sister, with whom I was terribly close all of our lives, who died of ALS. Those were the people that had composed me. I kept finding them inside me, seeing things that not only I thought they would like, but seeing things that they might have seen before I did. I felt their presence inside me, and I became more aware of myself as a multiple of someone who was made of different perspectives and different points of view, and someone who carried not only the living with me, but the dead with me as well, in a way that partly generated grief, but partly it is so important to me that I don't ever want to let go of it. I don't want to. There's all these books on grief and overcoming grief and the seven stages of grief, and it's that sort of have to do with our moving on from sadness. And I don't think, like Albert Camus says, you can't stay on in depression. You kill yourself or you make some change. But I think those changes that we can make to our suffering don't have to include leaving a sense of leaving that that emptiness behind us. I think we can cultivate that and carry the dead with us in a way that that's more connected to gratefulness and self-identity.
Yes, and hence the title Mojave Ghosts, and a poem on page 37 that I think is so apt to what you've just said. So I wonder if you could read that one as well.
Oh, sure. So one of the things that you've noticed in the poem is that, I mean, what we were just talking about, the sort of multiple selves that define who we are, the pronouns shift around a lot. And sometimes it's not clear who the you is. The you can be me talking to myself. It can be the landscape. It can be the beloved. It can be my mother. And I think that characterized my state of mind, not as a schizophrenia, but really as a kind of radical honesty, as I spent time in the desert. So here's the poem you asked me to read. Shifting light animates the room. What is so ordinary about living every day as we do, at the threshold of each other? Your emotions always visible in your eyes. In you, I find my consequence, my natural history. In your company, irrelevance drains away. But what is it that makes you special? Is it your intensity? It's your ardor. Never a sneeze, but a rapid parade of sneezes. My office door opening, smiling face peering around it. You said you couldn't help falling in love with me because I looked at you, quote, with the mesmerizing gaze of a border collie. Last night we parked in the roundabout at the end of the lane, just listening to the hiss of sodium vapor streetlights and watching cyclones of oak moths rising and falling. We, who are also taking place in this place. The moon siphoned away into clouds. Was I even there? Will I be there when you need me?
You know, I just love your exquisite attention to the quality of the other person, not just in this poem, but throughout this wonderful poetry volume, Mojave Ghosts. And now I should tell my listeners that we are speaking with the poet Forrest Gander about his latest volume of poetry. Mojave Ghost. The Native Americans say all my relations, and I think that that expresses very much what you were talking about before, that other cultures see automatically that everything is in relationship to everything else. And even our own science and physics understands that. But somehow our culture is still lost in that Descartesian alienation. This book takes place in several places, but of course, given the title, it's in the desert. You took walks. I think you covered some 600 miles. Is that right?
Yes, but not, it wasn't like Basho walking around Japan. I did take advantage of being able to drive to places and then hike. So they were interrupted hikes along the 650-mile San Andreas Fault.
So there, the San Andreas Fault kind of works as a real place and a metaphor, I think, in many ways, for the structure of your book. Is that correct, or do you see that relationship?
No, of course. I became intensely aware of how divided I was by the losses that I had on the one side and the possibility of happiness again on the other side of me, and how it was all rumbling through me, and I felt very divided and unsure of how to metabolize the conflicting feelings I have. And at the same time, I'm walking over a live fault zone where two enormous plates are shearing each other, and where the earth is literally screaming in decibels that are too small for us to make out. But walking over a live surface, the earth is this living body. In fact, some scientists say that the biomass under the surface of the earth is greater than the biomass on the surface of the earth. So all of that seemed to metaphorize what I was experiencing myself within me. The psychic became equal to the substantial, to the physical.
There was a poem that was very different at the end of the book, Rift Zone, which I think is more of a traditional poem. But you write in it that this is a riven land. This place belongs slowly to itself. I wonder if you could both comment on how it belongs only to itself, and also read an excerpt from the poem Rift Zone. And it covers three pages, and I'd love to invite you to read the whole thing. But if you'd rather read just a section or two, that's fine too. But I'd love you to make that choice, because I liked the whole poem.
So I write that the land belongs only to itself because geologically that's true. There's all this human internecine fighting over ownership and who owns the land. But the truth is no one owns the land, that we pretend to be owners of the land, even if we're terrible owners and completely abuse it, which is mostly the case in the 21st century. But the land will go on without us, and we've never truly owned it. It's itself. So I'm arguing against this notion of a human hierarchy and making the case for geologic time and thinking about the paltriness of notions of human ownership of things that go far beyond the human. So that poem, which finishes the book, is right different and is more like a traditional poem in the sense of its stanzas and line breaks. It begins like this. And I should say, a shell jacket and approach shoes are implements that rock climbers wear. Rift zone. And so find myself in a shell jacket and approach shoes, strolling past boulders on the Xeric canyon path, limbed with mustard flowers, as though it were my garden, as though I'd never drawn those distinctions that separate me out, as though I hadn't long back expelled myself from all that wasn't myself. But where is the human place in geologic time? Is there some quality in me that links I am to the remainder, to whatever is left over, left out? What in the world have I left out of me? Adjusting a headband beneath my hat, I lift the binoculars to my lined face. Displaced by lateral slip, the mountain's slopes have gone wonky. A human life. What is that anyway? Even here at the disturbance zone, I find myself pierced by birdsong, standing among trunks and vines risen from the ground, like the births and messages they are. A riven land. This place belongs solely to itself. From the wall of a crevasse, tree roots jut out into the air. The fault is the earth's junction box, where its wires are bared. The conflict churns underground, howling out in the faintest of decibels. Of course, there were signs, but no one of us witnessed the ballet of trees as the tectonic strain below them rose and they inclined suddenly toward each other from where they stood rooted to the parted lips of a widening rift. The earth humped and rolled, and the trees bowed forward and held their new pose, which strangely resembles a gesture of devotion. But back at the start, I was occupied with myself, as though I were never to be apart, as if I weren't both in and of it. Of what? So I hiked the long fault for some new point of view, asking, muddled with anxiety, what comes next, now that I can't claw my way any further from what doesn't resemble me. The earth keeps stretching, knuckling, stretching out from under itself, hungry for a new shape, a new address. It has tossed itself loose from its sheets and risen, leaving behind a note I suppose I could read if I tried. And then it goes on some more, but maybe I should stop there.
That's so beautiful and so apt, again, to what we were talking about. You know, there was one last part, and you've referred to it before, but that's the resonance with the current moment. And there was a very striking sentence in this book, Forrest Gander, in Mojave Ghost: "The future blows toward us without handholds. It is a gaping, and already a maw." And that's certainly how I'm feeling now. But where do we find the hope and connection in that terrifying maw that seems coming towards us much faster than we would like?
Well, I don't want to present myself as some prognosticating philosopher, but my intuition is that our attentiveness to our relationship to the world could change our relationship to the world so that it's less exploitative, that our relation to others could be less exploitative, and that has to do with a form of attention in a culture that's addicted to spectacle and entertainment, passive entertainment, really, for the most part. Already, you know, Elon Musk is promising to colonize Mars. And the geniuses of our time, Meta, is focused on artificial environments that people can download their brains into. But the world itself, the world that we've been given, is so fantastical, so rich, so unknown still, that, you know, that I in my secular prayers, I hope for the possibility of us developing through a different kind of attentiveness, the attentiveness that people seek in the desert, a visionary attentiveness, that we could find ourselves and a relationship with the earth and the non-human life on the earth that is sustainable. So that's my hope.
That is so beautiful. And I really think this marvelous book of poems requires that attention and urges it upon all of us. And it's just been a privilege to talk with you, Farah Skander, about this poetry volume and to look forward to more of your work.
Thanks, Francesca, for reading it so carefully and for your profound generative questions and your questioning mine in general. I love your series and the wideness of your interests.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, it's just been great to talk with you, and I hope we have the opportunity to talk with you again sometime.
Okay, me too. Thank you so much.
Farah Skander, Mojave Desert is out from New Directions Press. Next up, poet Damaris Hill tells us about her book of poems, A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. We've just had Black History Month, then Women's History Month, and now Poetry Month has begun. In 2019, I spoke with Damaris Hill about her poetry volume, A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing, The Incarceration of African American Women from Harriet Tubman to Sandra Bland. It covers all three, Black history, women's history, and, of course, poetry. Let's listen back to that conversation. From Harriet Tubman to Sandra Bland and Black Lives Matter, Black women freedom fighters have braved violence, scorn, despair, and isolation to fight for their rights. In A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing, Damaris Hill honors their experiences with responses to her heroes that are both harrowing and hopeful. In her love poems, as she calls them, to such women as Harriet Tubman, Zora Neale Thurston, Ida B. Wells, Eartha Kitt, and others, she pays homage to women who broke the bounds that racism and sexism tried to silence them with. She also honors women of lesser renown who fought back against chains, literal and otherwise, sometimes by violence, sometimes by breaking the law, but always with unbounded courage. Using poems, other writings, and photographs, Hill explores the different meanings of being bound, from slavery and incarceration to being bound to those we love, or bound for freedom. Damaris Hill's books include The Fluid Boundaries of Suffrage and Jim Crow, and a poetry collection, Visible Textures. A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing is out from Bloomsbury Publishing. In addition to being a writer, Damaris Hill teaches creative writing and English literature, African American studies, and women's studies at the University of Kentucky. Damaris Hill, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm so happy to talk to you.
Well, this was just a terrific book, not just of poems, but also of these kind of prose poem mini biographies. Very moving. A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing. The Incarceration of African American Women from Harriet Tubman to Sandra Bland. You say the poems in the book are love letters. Love letters?
Yes. I come from a religious tradition as far as my upbringing. Most of the people in my family, they are ministers. I was very much raised in a Methodist church. And being a creative child, of course, some of my first exposure to art, including music, visual art, and literature, was all biblically based in a very Methodist, which is a type of intellectual Christian tradition. And I think the idea of the hymn sticks with me even when I try to avoid it in my poetry. And so that's what I mean by like love songs and praise songs. Probably my earliest exposure was like a hymn, and maybe my knowledge of those types of love letters and praise songs evolved from there.
They also are poems of struggle, though. You know, you write that they will not comfort.
Yeah, I meant that.
And I can attest to that. They're strong. They're strong poems. So talk about this twinning of love and struggle.
Well, it was important to me that I kept those parallels in the poems. And I don't know if it's the twinning of love and struggle, but I definitely wanted to explore or try to explore in each poem the multiple entendres of bound. And if I was going to use the historical context with a negative connotation of oppressed or meaning fettered or held back, I also wanted to provide an opportunity in the poem for the subject in the poem to actually spring away from that or to find connections in love and provide a positive outlet in addition to the historical negative connotation.
You say that writing the poems have forced you to question what it means for a Black woman to engage in resistance. Could you explain that?
Well, we know that there's been significant cultural shifts over the past recent years about what are the mass messages about America and ideas of democracy and liberty and the polarizations of, let's say, rights an amendment. And so being a former service member and investing in these ideas of Americanness and nationhood in multiple ways in my professional life as a writer, as a researcher, again, as an armed service member, as a civil servant that was once a public teacher, and seeing how these ideas have been exploited and distorted in recent years. You know, violence is being passed off as democracy. And violence has always been an integral part of the American fabric. But now it's being given away wholesale in exchange for civil rights.
Are you talking, say, for example, about the white nationalists at Charlottesville?
I'm talking about Charlottesville. I'm talking about an individual prejudice that results in killings. I'm talking about collective prejudice and this belief in the mythology of white supremacy.
Do you think that it's something that has been strengthened or more just revealed by Trump?
Oh, I think it's been more revealed and is being marketed, because I think people that invest in white supremacy may be invested in white supremacy because the alternative would be to consider how white supremacy is not working in their favor.
Yeah.
Right? That's the alternative. Really dealing with the complicated notions of white privilege and how much privilege is not being accessed in whiteness in the same way that it has been before.
Divide and conquer is the way I talk about it.
Ooh. Yeah, you know, sometimes I theorize and I speculate and I wonder, what happened to all of this talk about the 1%? That seems to be gone. And now we have a more polarizing perspective of America.
Well, I think we could go down and talk about this quite a bit.
We can go down that rabbit hole and be there for a very long time, couldn't we?
Exactly. But I'd actually like to get back to your wonderful book.
Oh, thanks.
A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing. So, and really this, it's certainly relevant to what we're talking about. In fact, your second section, I'm going to jump to that, is titled okay. Bound, Fettered. Tell us, what are the multiple meanings of these two words for you in this book?
Well, you know, the book is in seven sections, I believe, six or seven sections. And bound, of course, I chose the word bound because it's a multiple entendre. So I open the book. The first chapter in the book is talking about how I'm bound to my ancestors, blood relatives, and otherwise. And then the end of the book is talking about how I'm bound to the next generation in terms of motherhood and what I owe the loyalty to the next generation. But in between, I talk about bound in the negative connotation of being fettered. I talk about bound in terms of demarcation. What does it mean to bind a book, to write something down, to make this statement in this very specific way that we value when we historicize things and create national narratives? What does it mean to be bound in that way? I also talk about bound in terms of philosophy and being hemmed in. What does it mean to be bound intellectually or to buy in intellectually to other belief systems?
And you also say at one point that using formal poetic structure is a way of being bound. And when I thought about that, I thought, you know, there are ways to be bounded or limited that inspire creativity. And it seems to me that that's one of them, to use the strictures of a poetic form.
Yes. So I think it's Toni Morrison, but I may be wrong, that says that writing is not only a matter of life, it's a matter of language. And so when we really start to unpack values in what we consider like, you know, high art and low art, or folk culture versus national and international like artistic mediums, language in terms of literature is a very integral part of that, right? And so what I'm playing with in the second section in terms of those women, that many of them were escaping chattel slavery or just coming out of a state of chattel slavery. They moved to Philadelphia, right? Because they believe that Philadelphia is the city of brotherly love and the seed of democracy in this country, right? This is the place where Americanness happens. And so these Black women migrate here. And when they migrate to Philadelphia in between the 1890s and 1910, as Callianne Gross talks about in Colored Amazons, they find themselves battling different forms of constraints and bondage. So rather than chattel slavery, there are economic constraints, there's open discrimination, there are limitations in the types of work that they can do because of education and or discrimination. So there are all of these additional social circumstances that limit their access to this American idea that motivated them to come to Philadelphia.
And some of them really, really fight back. And
some of them do fight back. And I just get so tickled at the ways that they fight back. Like Black Bess and Mermaid Stroll, I love that she's trying to convince men that she's a prostitute. And as soon as she gets in a dark corner, she's robbing them and keeping all of her goodies. It's brilliant. I love it.
And, you know, you also point out the different ways that Black women and white women were, you know, who did fight back or who were, you know, went outside convention, how they were treated, that Black women were judged to be criminal and white women were judged to be insane.
Absolutely. And I think we're still on some levels dealing with that distortion and that demonization of Black women acting against the norms. You know, there's an assumption of confusion and victimhood if white women act outside of the norms or if they evade expectations. But if Black women evade expectations or sometimes even meet expectations in a way that doesn't please people, they're often demonized and criminalized.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Damaris Hill about her narrative in verse, A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing. You say at a certain point, it's costly to stay free and appear sane.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Say more about that.
Well, if you are committed to these ideas of freedom, right? And I think a person that is free has to be committed to questioning what is freedom almost in every instance and in every choice. And we've already discussed how ingrained certain ideas like white supremacy and patriarchy that are invested in the mythologies of race and gender and norms, right, for what it means to be American. And if you're not invested in those hierarchies and you don't even reflect physically, emotionally, or mentally those hierarchies, then every negotiation, whether interpersonal or institutional, has to go back to that question, is this aiding in my ideas of freedom or not? And what are the benefits and consequences of that? And so that's what I mean, that it is costly to be free and appear sane, because my ideas of freedom don't always match up with those institutional expectations or the expectations of the person that I'm having an interpersonal relationship with.
That must have been incredibly difficult when you know, part of the armed forces. I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, I can't imagine a more hierarchical structure, one in which to be a soldier means to suppress your own individual reality. So talk about the contradiction, the tension, and how do you resolve it?
Well, let me at first say that this book is an exploration and there are many things that are unresolved, right? I'm just still evolving. And that's definitely one of them. You know, I kind of go into that in The Patriot and the Prisoner, which we definitely don't have time to read because it's a longer piece. But it explores my personal and intellectual investments in nationalism and scales them against the most formative relationship of my life, which means my relationship to my son.
Say more about that.
Oh, I don't know what else there is to say.
Well, you talk about your son who grew up with a beautiful spirit. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel in some way got ground down by the system, and who has tried to cope with that by, abusing substances.
Absolutely. That is a correct assumption. My son grew up in the era of hope, prior to the era of hope. As early as 2000, he was invested in like the news and politics. He was already expressing interest in that. You know, like most mothers, I invest in whatever my child wants to develop as far as his talents. And for my son, those talents included politics. My son was post-racial prior to the recent cultural conversion of 2015 and specifically 2016. Very aware and knowledgeable of national politics on an intimate level. And so I think what began for him, the struggle began for him probably as early as Trayvon Martin, but definitely when the Michael Brown verdict happened, because we talked about it on the phone. And then from there, his disappointment in the devaluing, at the blatant devaluing of Blackness in this country, I think it began to fray him, you know? And we talked about it often when before we never had to discuss it. So I want to also say that being a parent of any child is hard. But being a parent of a Black child in America, when you know white supremacy is looming, when you know discrimination is looming, and to promote that child's visions and dreams is a real strategic feat. And I thought we had accomplished that. And then once we are in college and, you know, my son is making strategic choices about his major and his friends based on his ambitions for politics. And then we have this incessant toxic, assault that begins to invade all layers and fabrics of public and private life. And so being a college student, heavily invested in politics, it can be a space with very little diversity. For the first time ever, he had to wrestle with the ideas that his white friends did not acknowledge his Blackness.
A terrible disappointment coming on the heels of a Black president.
On the heels of a Black president, at the toes of a white supremacist president, in the midst of your college career, which is supposed to be some of the happiest and most social points of your life, you know, on the eve of your professional career as a politician and realizing that your peers don't acknowledge your Blackness is probably a lot to struggle with.
Yeah, and this is echoed in the book very much. In this book, A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing, Damaris Hill. You know, the third section, bound/demarcation, boundaries, you write about the women who wrote about this kind of oppression. For example, you open the section with Ida B. Wells. Tell us about her, and, you know, she documented lynchings.
So Ida B. Wells was important, number one, because her life is a testament to the challenges of white supremacy, but also the ways that she demanded that people acknowledge the ways that white supremacist violence was affecting her and her community. So Ida B. Wells was important because most of us know her as a journalist and an educator. But I want people to understand that in the 1870s and 90s, right? Well, in the 1890s, she was on the forefront of demography and statistical documentation. And we don't talk about her in that very specific, high intellectual context. The journalism was for everyone else. It was to translate the statistics that she had been keeping. And she had networks. This is a Black woman, a young Black woman, who has networks all across the country where people are phoning into her and telling her about each lynching that's happening in their region. And she's keeping statistics. And then she's using the statistics in her newspapers to educate Black people and non-Black people and others about the violences that are happening in America. And yeah, I think what's happening in A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing in that section in terms of demarcation and boundaries is there are a few women that are noted in that chapter that are absolute geniuses that history and most narratives refuse to acknowledge their genius. And Ida B. Wells is definitely one of them.
And Zora Neale Hurston is another. I mean, she was acknowledged later. You know, we read about her. But in her own time, she died in poverty as a maid. So tell us about Zora Neale Hurston.
Well, I wrote specifically about Zora Neale Hurston in a context of her inspirations of becoming a writer and an anthropologist and just being a young woman. I mean, it's important to remember, you know, Zora as this sassy, unbothered, unrestrained, unbound intellectual, right? But when we think about her as a young woman in this emergent field of anthropology, where being a woman and being anything less than white, that the entire discipline believed that you were biologically inferior and less intelligent than any white guy in the room. For her to be in this field was remarkable, and I cannot imagine the amount of bias, scrutiny, negativity that she must experience in this one space. To have to study these mythologies of inferiority in order to receive your certification as a scientist must have been grueling at certain points. And then for me, imagining her experience without the burden of femininity and sexuality and the exotic desires of the men in this space is impossible. So I'm just talking about the intellectual burdens, but imagine the hashtag Me Too burdens that she was experiencing in this space.
Exactly. I mean, and that's certainly been true of other great African-American writers. Is it Toni Morrison and Beloved, for example?
Yeah, I mean, that, but also, yeah, like on, in the literary scape, but also these scientists that are obsessed with these hierarchies and the disposabilities of people that may or certainly do, some of them at least, have these ideas of sexual exoticism and savagery associated with Black women, right? And so I can't imagine how resilient Zora had to be to survive that space. I also want to like note that we don't talk about, and I think I found this in one of the archival pieces that were online about Zora Neale Hurston, that she was the archivist at an Air Army base that became Cape Canaveral in Florida. Can you imagine? And I think that the document said that she was fired for knowing too much. Yeah, right?
What you were just talking about, the exoticism, you know, I think of Josephine Baker, for example, who you don't write about here, but who also was a figure who played within the stereotype of that kind of exoticism and yet totally transcended it.
Very subversively, which was indicative of her time and space, of negotiating that space and negotiating her power in that space to make gains for people, right? But it's also important to know that that wasn't only Josephine Baker's tactic, but that's also Esther's tactic from the Bible, right? So this idea of subversively negotiating power for the collective good is not something that exclusively happened in an African-American context, but has a much larger tradition in terms of negotiating power for people who historically don't have any.
You also talk about Eartha Kitt, another one of these women who transcended stereotypes.
So I find this so funny, right? Because like we're talking about the erasure of Blackness. And like I think Eartha Kitt was one of those people in the 1950s and 60s that was embraced in a certain type of politic that was about unification and about the erasure of difference. And I'm not taking anything away from her talent. She was immensely talented as well. But she was one of those people who were included in that, right? And so she's invited to the White House for this type of summit and talk with Lady Bird Johnson. And apparently when she gets there, everybody's talking about table linen and the type of flowers that they want to align the highway. And she was like, well, I want to talk about Vietnam. I want to talk about how many Black and brown boys are dying. And then by the time she left the White House, it was already in the paper that she had made Lady Bird Johnson cry.
That's so powerful.
Yeah. And so it became this Eartha Kitt is a bully situation. And then from then on, she was being investigated by some of the highest offices in the United States and essentially blackballed. She did not work in the United States for at least a decade. She went back to her hotel. She had tour dates, and people spoke about her tour dates not existing, her hotel reservations being canceled. and her earnings were effectively stopped because she asked that question. Yeah, and I think it was a very painful thing for Eartha Kitt. So, of course, the popular memory of Eartha Kitt is all of her successes and the love that we had for her as fans. But people don't discuss how at the moment when she expressed concern for others, she was demonized.
And the CIA called her a sadistic nymphomaniac, which is...
Absolutely. That's exactly what they called her, a sadistic nymphomaniac.
I mean, just deconstruct that for a minute. Those two words put together are very peculiar.
And they hearken to ideas that I spoke about earlier about Black femininity, right? Not only criminal, but also very sexually available, right?
Exactly. And another person you talk about who talked about intersectionality, which I hadn't known about, was Fannie Lou Hamer.
Absolutely.
Tell us about her.
Well, Fannie Lou Hamer, of course, was an amazing person and continued to fight for the liberties of all and civil rights and to protest even in the face of death, rape, physical acts of violence that include beating, and continue to advocate for democracy. You know, it's so funny that on some of the national narratives, there are ideas about the enemy within, and it seems like Black women are disproportionately identified as the enemy within. But all of the Black women that I know, Fannie Lou Hamer, Angela Davis, Assata Shakur, Shirley Chisholm, these women that really call people to task on democracy are rarely acknowledged as being some of the most fundamental believers in democracy. You have to have a religious fervor for democracy in order to call people to task about what democracy should be and should not be. And that is not acknowledged. Yet people that are little invested in the ideas of democracy and use the term as a type of social currency, which has no substance or backing, are thought of being the upholders of democracy. It's just an irony or a truth of the United States that we rarely acknowledge. And I hope that this book begins to acknowledge that.
And it certainly does. I mean, this has been a fascinating conversation, but there's so much more in this book. A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing, The Incarceration of African American Women from Harriet Tubman to Sandra Bland. Thank you so much, Damaris Hill, for talking with us here.
Thank you so much, Francesca.
That was Damaris Hill speaking with me in 2019. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests at writersvoice.net. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.